This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 17th, 2021, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. On this midweek edition of our show, an update on the Arkansas effort to vaccinate more residents. And we hear from Nell Irvin Painter, the author of Creating Black Americans, African American History and Its Meanings, 1619 to the present. She'll be part of a virtual discussion tomorrow evening hosted by the Central Arkansas Library System. That conversation will be available to residents across the state. And in our second half hour, Dorothy Hoover was a pioneer in mathematics, aviation, and at the University of Arkansas. She's the subject of our next entry into the 150 years of University of Arkansas history. After Ozarks, on Here and Now, the news from around the country and from around the world, and the debut album of a baby girl created by her parents before she was even born. We'll hear Sounds of the Unborn and more on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on KUAF. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting an additional 12 deaths from COVID-19 in yesterday's report. There have now been 5,287 deaths. The most recent 24 hours of testing produced 177 new positive cases, though Governor Asa Hutchinson says testing is reduced because of winter weather and bad road conditions. Hospitalizations from the virus dropped by 4 patients statewide. There are now 638 people in Arkansas hospital COVID-19 units. Active cases in the state have been reduced by almost 1,400 during the last 24 hours. We'll have more about the latest state effort to slow the spread of the virus in just a few minutes when we hear highlights from yesterday's weekly COVID-19 briefing with Governor Asa Hutchinson. Hospitals in Northwest Arkansas report 51 patients are in COVID-19 units in Benton and Washington counties. The number represents a continued decline in hospital beds in the region required for people with the virus. Last week, the region's hospitals averaged 55 COVID patients per day. 3 weeks ago, that number was 81. 5 weeks ago, the week of January 11th, hospitals were averaging 128 COVID-19 patients per day. The National Weather Service's winter storm warning is in effect until 6 tonight for the region. Though snowfall is tapering off, there could still be an additional 2 inches of snow on the ground by the end of sunlight today. No melting tonight, lows in the teens. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs around 31 throughout the listening area. Highs Friday should be around 38, then the mid-40s by Saturday afternoon. Efforts to conserve power continue as energy providers grapple with high demand for homes and businesses. Cherokee Nation's casinos and businesses are staying closed today and tomorrow. Cultural sites will reopen Friday morning. Casino and entertainment venues scheduled to return to operations by early Friday afternoon. And make it 7 consecutive SEC wins for the Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team. Arkansas defeated Florida last night 75-64 in Bud Walton Arena. Arkansas is now 9-4 in league play and in second place. The last time the Razorbacks won 7 straight SEC games was during the 2014-2015 season. The record for SEC wins, consecutive SEC wins for the Razorbacks, 11. That came at the end of the 1993-94 campaign. This is Ozarks at Large. A second winter storm swept through northwest and western Arkansas late last night, adding a fresh layer of snow across the region. John Luther is Emergency Management Director for Washington County.
Well, I'd say that across the county, there's certainly been anywhere from 2 to 5 inches, just depending on where you are. But at this point, I think it's safe to say that we've got, 5 to 6 inches in numerous parts of the county from total of both storms, if not more.
Luther closely monitors storm data generated by the National Weather Service office in Tulsa, which provides his crew management guidance. He says road crews had cleared most major roads in the county, but are having to start from scratch this morning.
You know, my hat's off to those folks. They're out on dangerous road conditions to be able to get their work done, to make it able for us to get out and drive around and get to work as ourselves.
Luther says no fatalities have been reported in the county. Benton County Judge Barry Mooring was out surveying the storm impact early this morning.
Bella Vista probably got something different than Lowell, and the lake area probably got something different than Salem Springs, but it appears to be around 3 inches or so overnight.
Judge Mooring says accidents across the county have been few, and there have been no fatalities, with most residents staying off the roads.
Yeah, you know, I think conditions are still a little slick. I would say primary roads are being treated pretty quickly. Secondary roads we'll be able to get to, and then neighborhood roads will be on the way. I think we'll get way ahead of it today.
Jim Kelly is the assistant chief with Eureka Springs Fire Department. He says 3 inches of snow fell overnight in the region, which has been plagued by power outages.
Word was that we received was Holiday Island and Grassy Knob area for sure were out of power for a few hours, and I believe that was Monday during the day. South of town, I think they had a lot, south of Eureka, they had quite a few power glitches.
He says brief outages have affected the city of Eureka Springs as well, and he advises all residents just remain at home today. And the extreme winter weather has resulted in extreme demand on the 14-state Southwest Power Pool utility grid, resulting in rolling blackouts since Monday. With sub-zero temperatures easing, rotating outages in northwest Arkansas conducted by SWEPCO have ended, according to the spokesperson Carrie Sullivan. OG&E has also ended its controlled outages. In an email to Ozarks at Large yesterday, Pete Main, spokesperson for SWEPCO, says the utility is unable to provide specific notification to customers regarding the timing of controlled outages, which generally last from 1 to 2 hours at most. The electric cooperatives of Arkansas were also forced to implement emergency contingency plans that included short-term rotating power curtailments at some local electric cooperatives this week. Curtailments were discontinued as of 9 last night. Still, with fresh, deep snow across the area and temperatures remaining in the teens and low 20s until Friday, residents are encouraged to find ways to conserve power over the next few days until this Arctic cold system lifts. This is Ozarks at Large. Weather is having an effect on COVID-19 testing, and Governor Asa Hutchinson devoted the first few minutes of yesterday's weekly briefing about the virus to the pair of winter storms in the state this week. The governor says the snow, wind, and record-setting low temperatures are part of the most severe weather pattern he's seen in the state during his lifetime.
This is plaguing not just our state, but also our region, and that makes it even more complicated whenever you have Texas, gas shortages, power shortages, Oklahoma as well. The supply chain has impacted our state in Arkansas.
He says as a result of the weather emergency, he is extending the National Guard deployment through Friday for assistance to state residents. He says 100 guardsmen are deployed around Arkansas and says as of yesterday afternoon, at least 18,000 Arkansans were without power, most in south-central Arkansas. Frigid weather and compromised roads contributed to fewer COVID-19 tests on Monday, and that likely contributed to a smaller-than-recent number of new cases diagnosed. Governor Hutchinson says the state has so far administered about 70% of the 658,000 doses of vaccines supplied to the state, and he says the amount of vaccines distributed to Arkansas will increase soon.
I did have a call today with the White House Coronavirus Task Force, and it was announced at the meeting, at the call with the governors, that they are increasing these national supply allocated to the states by 2.5 million doses. And this is the largest weekly increase yet of our vaccines since our vaccine program was started. For Arkansas, this will mean an additional 6,000 to 7,000 doses per week. This is good news. We have not received those doses yet, so it is something that has been allocated, and we are expectant to receive those doses either this week or next week in terms of that increase.
As the spread of coronavirus seems to slow, the state is easing a bit on some regulations regarding indoor gatherings. In early January, as a surge in new cases continued, the state began requiring indoor gatherings of 10 or more people to submit plans to the Arkansas Department of Health for approval. The governor says the state is altering the requirement now, just a bit.
Because of the progress that we've made, we are raising that level again to 100 for an indoor event before you have to have the specific plan approved. There's still certainly guidelines to follow, but this should be helpful to everyone. And then next will be our school and community sports. Today on the website, they'll be posting the directive updated to allow competitions with two or more teams. The plan must be submitted to the Department of Health, and the host venue is responsible for compliance.
Restaurants and similar businesses are not part of the indoor directive and will continue to operate under already existing protocols regarding capacity. Governor Asa Hutchinson says the changes in the indoor requirements come after the new case reports begin to resemble the numbers from early autumn.
We can go back to where we were previously, where if you had 100 or more attendees at an indoor event, you have to get the plan approved. So this is not opening up the Wild West. It's not acting without department approval on major indoor events, but it gives more latitude for the smaller, could be weddings, it could be, you know, that's in a convention type center. It just makes life simpler in the planning. We have also put into place an additional guideline for these events to make sure they know, even if they're a smaller event, what they need to do to keep good health outcomes.
Dr. Jose Romero, the state's Secretary of Health, says so far no examples of COVID-19 variants have been detected in Arkansas, though he says health officials suspect they are here. He says the familiar rules of hand washing, staying socially distant, and wearing masks, two masks, as recommended by the CDC, are still absolutely necessary to keep another surge of the virus at bay. Dr. Romero says he had not heard, as of yesterday, of any hospitalizations impeded by the winter weather, and that the continued reduction in people in hospitals in the state with the virus is a true reduction of cases. The entire briefing can be viewed at the governor's YouTube channel. This is Ozarks at Large. Hope you're staying warm today. Peace activists are demanding the University of Arkansas terminate a nuclear weapons research and development collaboration with Honeywell International. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons cites the University of Arkansas to be among 50 college campuses engaged with the U.S. nuclear weapons complex.
In the spring of 2017, the University of Arkansas signed a master collaboration agreement with Honeywell International, the sprawling technology manufacturing company headquartered in North Carolina. It operates four sectors: aerospace, home and building technology, performance materials and technologies, and finally, safety and productivity solutions. But Honeywell also subcontracts components for conventional nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles and next-generation bombs to the U.S. defense industry. And that's what concerns Abel Tomlinson. He's Peace Action Committee Chair for the Omni Center in Fayetteville, as well as founder of the Arkansas Nonviolence Alliance.
ICANN, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, issued a report called Schools of Mass Destruction. And I read that report that said that there was 50 universities involved in nuclear weapons production in the United States, and the University of Arkansas was one of them.
U of A researchers and the College of Engineering are collaborating with Kansas City National Security Campus for the U.S. Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, managed and operated by Honeywell. The campus is a high-tech facility with thousands of employees, providing diverse engineering and manufacturing for national security. The partnership, according to a UA press release, advances the university's research mission. But Tomlinson says there's a federal military-industrial mandate driving the collaboration.
The nuclear arsenal modernization, as they call it, under Obama, it was $1 trillion. It's went up to now $1.7 trillion, I think, under Trump. So there's this massive influx of funding to renew the nuclear arsenal, to build a new generation of nuclear weapons, to update the old nuclear weapons, but also to build some new ones. And so there's this massive amount of money that's been injected into nuclear weapons research and technology development. These big corporations that are involved in nuclear weapons have all this funding, and you know, apparently it's advantageous to them to collaborate with universities, engineering departments and so forth, physics departments, to take advantage of university students' brain power and energy and to work with professors and to build these new nuclear weapons.
According to the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, the U.S. State Department currently counts more than 6,800 nuclear warheads in its inventory.
And some of the nuclear bombs, too, the development is for low-yield nuclear weapons, which activists that are involved in nuclear disarmament are concerned that these low-yield nuclear weapons would be more likely to be used.
During the peak of the Cold War, the U.S. maintained an arsenal of 32,000 nuclear weapons. But a bilateral arms control agreement with the Soviet Union back in 1967, called the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, placed a cap on these arsenals. Still, the U.S. and Russia maintain nuclear deterrence, what anti-nuclear war activists refer to as MAD, mutually assured destruction, with thousands of nuclear warheads aimed at each other.
And the grave danger of these is that not just that we would, you know, or someone would blow up a city, it's that if enough of these bombs go off at once, it could cause nuclear winter. That's the huge danger we face. And Daniel Ellsberg wrote about that in his book, The Doomsday Machine. And he said that, you know, if enough of these went off, it would send up so much dust and smoke into the atmosphere, it could block out the sun for 10 years, which would kill all plant life and all the animals and humans that depend on plants for food. So it would cause a mass famine. So that's the danger we're facing with nuclear weapons. And he also writes in the book how these nuclear war can start way more easily than we're led to believe.
Tomlinson is allied with ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, a global civil society coalition working to promote adherence to and full implementation of the 2017 Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. 82 nations have signed on. The U.S., Russia, and North Korea have not. The treaty went into full force on January 22nd. On that day, U.S. activists gathered on college campuses to protest nuclear weapons development collaborations, including the U of A's involvement with Honeywell.
We also created a petition to call on the cancellation of this agreement. We have at least 350 signatures so far and in counting. And I hand-delivered, after our protest event on the university campus, we hand-delivered the petitions, hard copies, to the top administrators in the chancellor's office and the engineering department, the dean of the engineering college, as well as the law school. And then subsequently, I emailed the petition and a letter about this to all of the faculty and staff of the engineering college, political science, law school, and the chancellor's office.
We queried Associate Vice Chancellor of University Relations Mark Rushing via email. He said the Honeywell Technology Research Collaboration Agreement concerns topics of mutual interest and includes a student component focused on senior design projects. All areas of collaboration, he says, are lawful and appropriate, and the collaboration has been beneficial to the university's research mission. The research is not classified, he said, but there's a non-disclosure agreement in place barring answers to reporters' detailed queries. With a global pandemic, massive civil unrest, and climate change, the consequences of an intentional but quite possibly an accidental nuclear exchange have faded from the news, which is why Tomlinson will continue to press the University of Arkansas to terminate its agreement with Honeywell.
And, you know, their own report said that they're involved in a nuclear security contract with Honeywell at the National Security Campus, which pretty much all they do at the National Security Campus is build nuclear weapons, produce 85% of the non-nuclear components of the nuclear arsenal. That's what that campus does. And so certainly they're involved in building nuclear weapons. And we're committed to a long-term campaign to try to get them to cancel this. We're going to be holding monthly demonstrations the next 3 months throughout the semester, and then we're going to work on seeing if we can get a city council resolution to see if the city can help put pressure on the university.
In 2017, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which published the report Schools of Mass Destruction, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for drawing attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, and for its groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Still to come on this edition of Ozarks at Large, curling up with a good book sounds great right about now. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda will explain how the Gravett Public Library is embracing reading in winter. That's in about 1 minute on today's Ozarks at Large. The movie Minari continues to receive great reviews. The New York Times made it a critic's pick this weekend and called it nothing less than a lovely film. Lee Isaac Chung's movie is inspired by his youth in Lincoln. It's set in the Ozarks and was filmed in Oklahoma. Last week, the movie was screened as part of a program by the Arkansas Cinema Society at the 112 Drive-In, as well as virtually, and those available spots were spoken for pretty quickly. But we have new opportunities to see Minari through February 25th. A link at screeningroom.a24films.com will allow you to purchase tickets for a virtual viewing. The movie is screened virtually once a day through the 25th and will be available for a four-hour window with the ticket purchase. One note, many of the screenings available have already sold out. Again, that link, screeningroom.a24films.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for KUAF comes from the Malco Theaters, offering reserved recliner seating and following all COVID-19 safety guidelines at the Rogers Cinema Grill and Razorback Cinema Grill and IMAX Theater in Fayetteville. Showtimes, tickets, and information available at malco.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Snow days are a great time to curl up on the couch with a good book, and the Gravett Public Library has brought back a popular program that will add a little mystery to local bookworms' reading material. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
Blind Date with a Book has returned to the Gravett Public Library for the month of February. The annual event made its debut in 2017 when the library was working to add new programs and activities to its offerings. Library Director Karen Benson says they're having fun with the program, which provides a way for readers to meet new authors and discover new genres.
It's something that our patrons actually look forward to every year, and it's patrons of all ages. The children love it. They love to come in and look for the books that have their sticker on it.
Books are wrapped in brown paper to hide the cover. Staff members then place a red heart sticker on the wrapping to denote the book's intended audience.
So there's children, young adults, juniors, which are the older children, and we have books also for adults. And then each book has a tag on it that gives a hint about what this book is about. So this one says, "Hello, I'm spooky and frightful. We'll have an unearthly good time." So it's something that's just, it's kind of taken off and it's pretty popular. We enjoy doing it and we enjoy seeing everyone have fun.
Staff members have chosen books from a variety of genres for the program.
Of course, we already have some tags already made. So we're looking for some that fit those, whether they're historical fiction, they're Christian fiction, they're the children's fiction. This one says, "Hello, I'm real and true. I'm real and true." And so this indicates to me this is probably a nonfiction book. So you can kind of tell from the tags which areas in the library we were choosing books from.
Last year, the library started inserting a piece of paper into each package so readers could provide feedback.
It gives the patron an opportunity to rate the book, to let us know, was this a dud or was it love at first sight? And so, and there's a place for them to comment so they can tell us, you know, this book, it was a little slow to start, but I finally got into it. Or, you know, this is a genre that I probably won't read again, you know, so, or this is a book I really like and I want to read more by this author. So it gives us a little bit of feedback.
The library has been open regular hours since June 1st. However, if you're uncomfortable being indoors in a public space, curbside pickup is available.
You can call up and say, "Hey, would you pick out a blind date book for me?" And we would go out and we would look for a book. If you had a preference, you know, we would try to go with your preference. We could kind of give you some ideas like, you know, what do you like? You know, and then we would check that out. Of course, we can't scan anything. Everything is wrapped. And so we put our item numbers on the back so we can check those out. And we even go so far as to take a permanent marker and mark through the title on your receipt. So you can't cheat and look at to see what is on the what the book was that you checked out. You have to wait till you get home and unwrap it.
The Blind Date with a Book program runs through the end of the month. The Gravette Public Library is open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturdays. More information is available at gravettelibrary.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Tomorrow night, Nell Irvin Painter, historian, author, and artist, will take part in a virtual conversation about her work, the role of art in helping explain history, and more. The discussion is hosted by the Central Arkansas Library System. In a different time, Nell Irvin Painter would be in Little Rock to deliver an in-person talk, but the pandemic has shifted so many things to a virtual landscape. This means the Central Arkansas Library System is making tomorrow night's conversation and conversations with other speakers in 2021 available to residents across the state. In advance of tomorrow night's event, we called Nell Irvin Painter. She is retired from Princeton University as the Edwards Professor of American History Emerita, and she has served as president of the Organization of American Historians and as president of the Southern Historical Association. We asked her about her book, Creating Black Americans, African American History and Its Meanings, 1619 to the Present, a book that includes art with history. She says art can help supplement history in two very big ways.
One is that artists can bring passion to history. So for me, as a scholarly historian, I don't bring passion to my narrative. I bring scholarly soundness. It's my job to go to the archive and read the primary and secondary sources, and out of that, forge a narrative that is faithful to the archive. So I'm kind of dispassionate as a scholarly speaker, but artists can be passionate about the topic, and American history, African American history are passionate topics as well. So that's one role that the artists, plural, can play, that is to bring the passion that many readers bring to the reading, actually, so it can satisfy the needs of readers in a way that a scholarly narrative doesn't. The other way is reinforcing one of my basic thoughts, and I hope messages in history, is that the history and the past are not static. You can't look through documents or look into the past and see something that doesn't change. What we consider history, what we want from history, changes over time according to who is asking the questions and what those questions are. So, for instance, the first time I really understood that with great clarity was the time of the Vietnam War. And I was a historian in training at Harvard. The questions that were swirling around us because of the Vietnam War were not the questions that the historians whose work we were reading had brought to the quest. The idea that there might be causes of wars that were not reliable or even not truthful, the fact that there might be information withheld from citizens, the fact that citizenry might be divided, all of that was in the newspapers, on TV, on a daily basis during the Vietnam War. And so historians of that era took those questions into the sources. And by bringing different questions, they found new answers. So artists whose version of the past, or whose versions of past figures, say Frederick Douglass or Martin Luther King Jr., artists portray them in different ways. So I can show by showing you two or three different images of, say, Frederick Douglass, I can envision different questions being brought to historical figures or historical eras or historical events.
Interesting. And of course, understanding history, and you mentioned the Vietnam War era, it's I guess, as important. This is a hard concept, I guess, but it's as important to know what you don't know about history as what you think you know.
Yes, and perhaps it's easier to know or to not know that there are things you don't know when you have new questions.
Right. And of course, if it's history of Africa or African Americans, the history of slavery or Jim Crow, there's just a lot of history that has not been shared with so many Americans, especially, you know, academically.
No, especially white Americans.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So one thing that's very different from the last time we had a real reckoning with the meanings of citizenship and the functions of race in our society was the 1960s and 70s. At that time, there were very few African Americans or allies of African Americans who could command a wide audience. And there was also very little in print or circulating in the media that was widely accessible about the issues. So it was a harder time to talk about the issues. Now we are two generations into African American studies and American studies that takes race, class, and gender into account. And we have lots and lots of people who are on television, who are in the media, who can talk about these issues in a knowing way. So there's just much more reliable information. Two generations of scholarship have laid down a foundation on which anti-racist can stand.
What would you like readers and students, and I mean that in the you know, academic sense, but in the general sense too, to come away with when they seek history?
Oh gosh, it depends on who the audience is, what the history is, and what the goal is. So, for instance, what a middle school student would need is different from what a college student will need, which is different from what a general reader will seek. So, I can't lay down one rule or one means of guidance that works for everybody. And so I guess my next statement is what I said was one of my foundations of the way I want people to understand history is that things change. When I first said that, I was speaking chronologically, that the questions we have of the past in 2021 are different from the questions we had of the past in 2010. Or 1995,
right?
Or 1972. But also, how we talk about the past changes and for what purpose. So, for instance, if you want to understand the history of Central High School, for instance, if you are an architect or a city planner, you might want to know about the roads and the building and the history of the building and the materials and the function. If you're a social historian, you'll want to know about the students and about the questions that the teachers brought into the classroom. If you're a historian of public policy, you'll want to know about the legal and legislative underpinnings of what happened in that building. So there's no one answer.
Gotcha. Finally, I'm curious how technology might have changed, if at all, how you present or think about history. Obviously, we're talking about the fact that you'll be able to do this virtual conversation with the Central Arkansas Library System. Mm-hmm. But now when you think of, you know, in 1970, if you were talking about history and art together, you pretty much had to rely mostly on two-dimensional sort of things. And now you can have audio or film or visual.
Yeah. Which does, if I were in the classroom, which I'm not, I would definitely be taking advantage of that. As an artist who makes books that combine history and imagery, I work back and forth between the hand and the computer. So my work is manual and digital. So I will draw by hand. I will scan. I will digitize my images and manipulate them digitally, and then perhaps project them or perhaps print them. So that's my main interaction with the way I make art now. I also am able to send my art around electronically. So you're able to look at my website, for instance, and see my work, even though we're not even in the same time zone.
Nell Irvin Painter is a historian and author, and she'll be in conversation with moderator Jessica McDaniel tomorrow night, beginning at 6:30. We reached Nell Irvin Painter by phone last week. You can find out more about her and the event at cals.org, C-A-L-S.org.
This is KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. 20 degrees below zero. And we're not talking about wind chill. A temperature of 20 degrees below zero. The occasional snow and ice are one thing. But for most Arkansans, as well as Oklahomans, Missourians, and Kansans, these are temperatures never before experienced. How do you stay warm? What's your favorite snow day board game? Or maybe you know of a group or organization that might be needing some extra help during this Arctic freeze. Call the KUAF Connects line at 479-575-6577 and let us know how the cold is affecting you. That's 575-6577.
As part of a larger plan to curb carbon emissions, the city of Fayetteville has adopted new regulations for businesses installing electric vehicle charging stations. The city council approved the standards in January that deal with charging stations publicly available on private property. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth spoke with the city's environmental director, Peter Nierengarten, about the new regulations and about Fayetteville's push for energy conservation.
Can you tell me just a little bit about the electric vehicle charging stations and the regulations that the city set out for them and kind of how the city settled on those?
Previously, the city didn't have any regulations or guidance with respect to what those stations needed to provide or consist of or have associated with them. And so we've essentially spelled out some basic requirements for what those EV charging stations need to be. There's a voltage requirement, an amperage requirement, which is essentially about, you know, how much electricity the charging station can provide to a vehicle. There's some signage requirements, some connectivity requirements, and all of that is just to make sure the public is aware of where the locations are. And if there's a charge associated with the using the charging station, then that's made available to the public. And then online, they can find the station and see if the station is available for them to charge at.
Putting these regulations in place and maybe making charging stations more available, how is that pushing the energy action plan goals, you know, for 2030 and 2050 that the city has?
Right. So we have goals in our energy action plan, which the city council adopted back in January of 2018 in several areas. And one of those areas is around reducing emissions from vehicles. And so as much as we are able to promote and encourage the transition away from internal combustion gasoline engines to electric vehicles that use electricity for fuel and simultaneously transition our electricity supply away from fossil fuels into renewables, then we're able to clean the emissions or improve the carbon footprint of the emissions from those vehicles. And so vehicle electrification is a pretty effective strategy at doing all of that.
The city is also has a plan to put in charging stations in city-owned parking lots, correct?
We're working on that plan right now. I wouldn't say we have the plan completely ironed out, but we've been in conversations with our two electric utilities, Ozarks Electric and Southwestern Electric Power Company, about cooperative arrangements with respect to installing charging stations. We are also looking at the money that just came available through the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality on February 1st. That is rebate money for the installation of electric vehicle charging stations on public property. And then there's also rebates available for stations installed on private property. That money is now available. It actually comes from the Volkswagen settlement. If you'll remember the vehicle emissions cheating that Volkswagen was found guilty of back in like 2014 or 2015. They had to pay a big settlement as part of that. And part of that settlement amount that came to the state of Arkansas is now being offered in terms of in the form of rebates and incentives for electric vehicle charging stations. So we're hoping to leverage those rebates to get some charging stations installed at some of our downtown parking lots and potentially at some of our parks facilities or other facilities that are kind of more on the periphery of the community.
And then going beyond the electric vehicles and the charging stations, you know, what other measures does the city need or is working toward to kind of push those action plan goals?
So we have several action plan goals beyond just the vehicle emission goals. We have goals around clean energy. We have goals around waste reduction. We have goals around building energy usage. So we've been focusing hard on trying to transition our electricity supply for city government buildings away from fossil fuels and to clean energy, to renewables. In 2019, we cut the ribbon on a 10-megawatt solar array at our two wastewater treatment plants that helped move the city's footprint of clean energy from about 16% clean energy supply to 72% clean energy supply. So that was a huge step forward for us. We're looking at other possibilities and options for the remaining clean energy supply and transitioning that over to renewables in the near future. We are looking at strategies for increasing the number of trees that we plant across the city to both combat heat island impacts or the heat that comes from paved surfaces during hot summer months and the impact that has on energy use on nearby buildings by cooling and shading the streets and the paved surfaces with more trees being planted and also providing stormwater benefit to the city. We're working on energy efficiency improvements in our buildings, transitioning away from older lighting supply to newer LED lighting. There's renewed interest in, working in partnership with other communities and with the federal government on clean energy and energy efficiency and electric vehicles and a transition away from a fossil fuel economy to a cleaner economy. And Fayetteville is committed to working with our partners on that transition and improving our, reducing our carbon footprint as much as we are able to do so.
And I guess I have just one more question. You know, how have people like businesses or business owners responded to the possibility of charging stations? Are they open to it? Are people not receptive? Are they unreceptive to regulations? I mean, how has that been?
I haven't heard a ton from businesses. I have visited with Colliers about the charging stations that they installed on Dixon Street, which if you haven't seen it, is a really impressive installation that they did at their drugstore. But yeah, they their charging station setup completely complies with our regulations. And I think it's just an example of what we'd like to see more of across the city of Fayetteville.
That was Peter Nierengarten, the City of Fayetteville Environmental Director, talking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. The University of Arkansas is observing the 150th anniversary of its founding this year. And the celebration will continue through part of next year when they mark the 150th anniversary of the first classes taking place. As the campus continues to observe the sesquicentennial, We're sharing the stories of past students, faculty, and events from the last century and a half. This time, Charlie Allison, the executive editor for University Relations at the U of A, tells us about a student who is a pioneer in so many ways.
As part of Black History Month at the university, I thought it would be fun to hear about Dorothy Hoover, an aeronautical research scientist who earned her master's degree in physics at the University of Arkansas during the early days of the university's desegregation. You might have read the book Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetterly, or way back before the pandemic, you might have seen the movie of the same name. The book tells the true life story of female African-American mathematicians who played a critical role in the development of jet flight and eventually the U.S. space program. And Dorothy Hoover was one of those women. Hoover was born more than a century ago, 1918, just outside Hope, Arkansas, and she grew up there. At age 16, she made her way to Pine Bluff to attend the Arkansas Agricultural Mechanical and Normal College, known today as the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. In 1938, she earned her undergraduate degree in mathematics. After graduating, she taught briefly in Arkansas, Tennessee, and Georgia, and then earned a master's degree from Atlanta University in 1943. Soon after graduation there, Hoover took a job as a mathematician at the Langley Research Center, the nation's oldest institute for aeronautical research. In her role at Langley, Hoover provided the mathematical equations and calculations necessary for designing jet planes that could travel faster than the speed of sound. Supersonic speed wasn't a given. In those days when airplanes started nearing the speed of sound, they met a sudden rise in aerodynamic drag. Shock waves formed in the flow of air as it moved across the body and wings of a plane, which caused the drag as well as enormous stress on the plane. This became known as the sound barrier, and some thought it would be an impossible barrier to break. The researchers at Langley, though, intended to find a way to break through it. Because of her mathematical prowess, by 1946, Hoover began working directly with Robert T. Jones, who was perhaps the top aeronautical engineer of the century. Their work focused on analyzing stability in aircraft and then increasing that stability during flight. It led to the development of swept-back wings. Those are the angular, tapered wings that you see on all the jets today. They allow an aircraft to gain even more speed while also maintaining better stability. The next year, 1947, pilot Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in a test rocket plane. Dorothy Hoover continued her computational work on swept-back wings with a new engineer, Frank Malvestuto. She co-authored two significant research articles with Malvestuto about the tapered wings and was promoted to aeronautical research scientist. But at what seemed like a pinnacle in her professional life, Dorothy Hoover left Langley in 1952, returning to Arkansas. We don't know why for sure. It might have been the changing mission of Langley or Hoover's personal life, or a combination of the two. Her mother died in the late 1940s, as did her first husband, leaving her a daughter to raise on her own. In 1950, she married Richard Hoover, and they had a son. But the couple divorced 2 years later, just before she moved back to Arkansas. So there was a lot going on in a short period of time. Being home near family might have just been what she needed. The author Shetterly also thought, perhaps, that Hoover's strong interest in theoretical math caused her to take a step away from the engineering-dominated world that Langley had become. Regardless, while back here, she enrolled at the University of Arkansas and pursued a master's degree in physics. The physics department was still relatively small, just 7 professors, but it had added graduate-level courses in 1942, including some that would have appealed to her. A theoretical physics course, for instance, and another named Pressures, Stresses, Vibrations, and Their Measurements. She probably could have taught that one. She finished in 1954. Part of her master's thesis, which was titled On Estimates of Error in Numerical Integration, was included in the proceedings of the Arkansas Academy of Science the next year. The university had only started desegregation 6 years earlier, and so when Hoover graduated, I think she became the first Black woman to earn a degree at the Fayetteville campus. She graduated in June 1954, and Thelma Benton, another Black pioneer on campus, graduated at the end of the following semester. Upon graduation, Hoover was offered a John J. Whitney Fellowship to go to the University of Michigan, where she continued the study of mathematics and physics at the doctoral level. Before finishing her doctorate, though, she moved her family to Washington, D.C. and took a job with the U.S. Weather Bureau. Just 3 years later, in 1959, Just a year after NASA was established, she transferred into NASA's newly named Goddard Space Flight Center, America's first space center. She was one of the very few female mathematicians at Goddard, where she continued her theoretical work, both mathematics and physics, as related to flight. But instead of airplanes or jets, Hoover was working on Project Mercury, the effort to send an American astronaut into space and then into orbit, both of which occurred in 1961 and 1962, respectively. During this exceptional professional period, she faced two tragedies in her own life again. Her son Ricardo died in 1967 at age 17. The very next year, her daughter Viola died at age 22. Soon after, Dorothy Hoover, by then 50, retired from work at Goddard Center. She lived another 30 years in Temple Hills, Maryland, and wrote a book about the history of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Dorothy herself died in the year 2000. In 2017, Dorothy Hoover's life's work was recognized in a presentation at the annual Joint Mathematics Conference in Atlanta. Professor Ulrika Wilson of Morehouse College lectured on the complex theoretical math in which Hoover had been engaged. Beyond the math and calculations, Wilson also found that whenever Dorothy Hoover was invited into the research room, she made a significant contribution to the discussion. At Arkansas, her name lives on in Senior Walk, just between Old Main and Gearhart Hall. And fittingly, her name is just below the windows of the offices of the graduate school. And Senior Walk? Well, that's a story for another day. For today, remember Dorothy Hoover, a pioneer at the U of A, but more importantly, a research scientist who used the finite sensibility of mathematics and physics to lead us toward the infinite possibilities of space exploration.
Charlie Allison is Executive Director for University Relations at the University of Arkansas, and his Hill Talk segments are helping us remember some of the people who have been part of the University of Arkansas community for the past 150 years. The 150th anniversary of the founding of the U of A is next month. There are events planned for the next several months. You can find out more at 150.uark.edu. That's the number, 150.uark.edu.
It's important to know what's going on, but keeping up can be a lot, especially with those news alerts blowing up your phone, leaving you stressed and confused. When you need some shelter, a safe haven from the noise, you turn to public radio. I'm Jen White, and KUAF is your space for respectful, thoughtful dialogue and reporting that breaks down the big ideas. Bring yourself future moments of peace. Give online at supportkuaf.com.
Thank you, Jen White. You can hear 1A every weekday morning from 9 to 11 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Dora. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, and Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Contributors to our show this snowy Wednesday included Jacqueline Froelich, who also delivered the updated information and sound regarding energy providers and winter weather, Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, and Charlie Allison. Our show was produced by Timothy Dennis in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Our theme, written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find out more about Daryl online and find his music wherever you find music online. We will be back with you tomorrow for a new Thursday show at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to us when you'd like to listen to us. All of our daily shows available as a free podcast. You can find them through any of the major podcast distributors. You can also go to KUAF.com to find out more about Ozarks at Large and all of the other programs that KUAF offers. Thanks so much for spending part of your Wednesday with us. Please stay warm. Please stay well. Get rest when you can. I'm Kyle Kellums. We'll talk again soon.